Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Already known as the most repressive regimes with no tolerance for second opinion locally, lately Central Asia's autocratic leaders are stepping up their pressure to silence their opponents even in exile. Uzbekistan, Tajikistan tops the list, but trends are also on the rise in the remaining countries in Central Asia. And sadly, in some cases, those leaders find allies in Western countries to achieve their objectives. On today's debate, we will have a microscopic look into the situation to understand what is really happening and why it is happening and impact it is having. In doing so, we will benefit from the findings of the Foreign Policy Center's latest report involving the subject. To discuss this, I am delighted to be joined by two authors of the report. They are Adam Hogg, who is the Policy Director of Foreign Policy Center. Adam, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you very much for having me.
Very nice to have you. Dr. John Hedershaw, professor at the Exeter University, is also co-author of the report and joining us from UK today. John, welcome to the Majlis again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also joining us, Ruslan Matiev, editor at the Alternative News Turkmenistan, who's exiled in Europe. Ruslan, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Kyrgyzbek Kanunov, journalist and founding member of the Tajikistan's Coalition of Civil Society, is also with us today. He is exiled in the United States. Kyrgyzbek, welcome to the Majlis.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. Also, we have Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog. Gentlemen, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Okay, before to kick off the debate, let me remind you that please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with the points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt you a question so that we have a lively debate today. With this, Adam, let's start with you with sort of a reality check on the ground. I've been reading your report, which is quite an extensive document. We will not be able to touch all the points raised in countries discussed, but just to set the agenda, let's look into your findings in Central Asia. You have certainly done similar projects in the past. So what are some of the striking points in this report?
I think obviously perhaps the most striking part is the way in which Tajikistan has jumped up the agenda in the last couple of years. I think both in the work that John Hedershaw has done through the database that I'm sure he'll talk about in a minute, but also Dr. Edward Lemon's contribution and those of others, are showing the way in which the Tajik authorities have really stepped up the pressure outside of Tajikistan, both inside Russia but also in Istanbul and across Western Europe within diaspora communities to put pressure on exiles. I think obviously you have to understand, you know, obviously Uzbekistan is also a joint top of the list, as would be expected. And then obviously the report looks at different other countries, including Kazakhstan, who are reasonably sophisticated in the way in which they are putting pressure on their exiles, predominantly through formal legal channels, and then similar countries elsewhere, so Azerbaijan, just the other side of the Caspian, doing similar things. And obviously, our report looks at the pressures that the security services put on exiles themselves, but also at those family members and friends and contacts who are left behind in country. We looked at that specifically in terms of Azerbaijan, but it's picked up by a number of our authors in terms of other countries, particularly in Central Asia. So I think those are some of the things that we'd flag up, and the way in which Russia is increasingly cooperating with the Central Asian security services to do their dirty work and ensure that no matter whether there's a European Court of Human Rights judgment or not, that people who are wanted by the regimes in Central Asia are returned if they're on Russian territory.
Mm-hmm. John, what are the groups chased by the authorities? You mentioned among them are political opposition, journalists, and how the pressure evolved also compared to the previous years?
Well, in the Tajik context, which Adam raised, there are two particular groups over the last 4 or 5 years who have become the target of persecution and oppression from the Tajik authorities. They are Group 24 and the Islamic Revival Party. And we can see particular processes where within the country, they were each identified as terrorist movements extraordinarily spuriously. And then as their members within the country were arrested, intimidated, tortured, it appears, in some cases, and jailed for a long period of time. In tandem with that, overseas, it seems the Tajik security services were using its contacts in Russia, Turkey, and elsewhere, and even using and abusing supposedly liberal international mechanisms such as the International Policing Service, Interpol, to track these exiles overseas. So it's the way in which the territorial within Tajikistan and the extraterritorial are connected, which is particularly interesting academically, but desperately worrying and really quite terrifying, I think, if you're on the end of it. Because if you are in exile, you always have a weak spot, it seems, and that is a friend or a family member at home who can be pressured and intimidated. And, you know, the security services have proved to be really very effective and with very little moral limit to how they do that, it seems, from the research we've been able to do.
Mm-hmm. We have one of the victims here among us today talking about Tajikistan, obviously, Kyrgyzbek Kanunov. Tell us, please, how this pressure against exiled opponents or dissidents by the Tajik authorities are felt where you are. How do you feel personally this pressure?
Well, to begin with, I'd like to go a little bit to the history of the post-Civil War Tajikistan. And I think it's very sad to observe today that, you know, a country that could have been as a good example of or a very interesting study case in Central Asia, where after a five-year devastating civil war, the conflicting parties eventually, under the pressure of international community, managed to come together and create a shared government. And it seemed that they had all the potential for cooperation, etc. Today are going backwards and ruining everything that was gained by the peace accord that was signed. And I think part of the reason is I would say that the United Tajik opposition, to be fair, should take some of this, a fair share of the blame as well.
Definitely, we will talk about that, Kyrgyzbek. But first of all, I just wanted to hear how this pressure is felt as someone who is facing this in your own life story.
As John mentioned, of course, most of us have families left behind and friends and etc. And of course, they become the target of persecution and harassment from the government side because, I mean, even from my personal experience, there were cases when my friends harassed by the authorities and, eventually I had to stop communicating with basically almost all of my contacts back home, except for my immediate family. You know, it's very sad that over the last 3-4 years, the government has become very aggressive towards any form of activism and, opposition, etc.
Mm-hmm. Probably this is one of few reports where Turkmenistan doesn't top the list of worst offenders, Ruslan, but by no means it is not trying such tactics as the other Central Asian countries do as we speak. Relatives of our own journalists are under constant pressure. Then you have Gildi Kariza, for instance, the former horseman turned activist, and Mohammed Bayhanov, leader of Harakat opposition movement. Both of them are being recently chased in Moscow and harassed. Ruslan, you are one of the such people in Turkmenistan's radar. How do you feel the pressure by the authorities in your day-to-day life? How does it affect to your family back home in Turkmenistan?
Well, luckily, I haven't personally experienced this type of pressure, physical pressure like Bayhanov experienced or Gildi Karizov experienced. And it's not to say that it might not be the case in the future, and I hope it's not the case in the future. Also, another lucky point is that my immediate family members are here with me in a safe place, so to say. But the same cannot be said about my far relatives who are still in Turkmenistan. And one of the tactics that the Turkmen security services use is intimidation, is pressure on relatives, intimidating them with all different things, you know, issues at work, problems at work, problems with being enrolled in a university, all different threats, after which, of course, they prefer not to communicate with me or with my family members. And they see us as the source of these problems.
Bruce, obviously you are monitoring Central Asia for a long, long time now, 3 decades to be precise. It existed in the past and it continues today. How this pressure by the Central Asian authorities to people in exile evolved over the past years?
Well, I think you said it exactly right. You know, I mean, from the very early days, most of these governments were trying to exert some pressure outside the country on people who they considered to be political opponents for some reason or another to get a hold of them and somehow either mute their message, cut them off from contacts with Western organizations. But they didn't resort to the extreme means that we see documented in this recent report from Mr. Hogue and Mr. Heathershaw and Alex Cooley, of course, too. So I think that, like I said, you've put it exactly right. They've gotten better because they've learned over the course of time what they can do and what they can get away with, and they've built up a new system of connections which extends far beyond their own borders now. It started pretty much within the confines of the CIS, and now it has gradually moved on a little bit. And you know, let's face it, a lot of these places where these attacks occur are places where they have migrant laborers for Central Asia, and we assume and have heard rumors that in fact the security agencies of all the Central Asian governments send their own people along with these migrants. So anywhere you have migrant laborers, someone among them is a plant, so to speak, there to monitor the activities of the other migrant laborers and see what they're up to. And in the course of that, of course, they can identify people of interest to the governments back home and keep watch on them and act perhaps a little bit more forcefully in cases when the governments deem that necessary.
Just to add to what Bruce was saying there, I think what has changed is more the context, where it has taken some time for significant political diasporas of Central Asians to emerge. Partly that might be because there was more space within countries, certain countries, Tajikistan being the obvious one, for a period of time before that was closed down. But I don't know how much has changed in terms of the practices of the security services. I mean, I think what we find in the research actually is there's a great deal of continuity from the Soviet era, particularly in terms of the connections between security services officers. You know, the culture of the KGB essentially, and the connection between Central Asian officers and Russian officers in particular, many of whom may have started their careers and may have known one another for some time. So, you know, for me, there's a great deal of continuity here, but because of the shift in context, we see an acceleration of activity. And, of course, also the changing context of an online community, which mobilizes, but can also be surveilled and is a means of intimidation and repression in and of itself, that kind of surveillance of the online community. So I think those contextual changes are really important. And the report, No Shelter, talks a bit about that, particularly Mark Galeotti's work about those security service connections.
Mm-hmm. Adam, in the report, there was a paragraph or two in which it says that even the scholars or religious personalities are also among the groups who are targeted today. So is there any change among the group of people being targeted compared to the previous years?
Well, I mean, I think obviously, a number of different authors in the report talk about the way in which the security narratives around anti-terrorism have been used both to deal with real threats from those who are, diaspora communities who are joining extremist groups, but also the way in which those narratives have been used to cover non-violent religious organizations as well, and the ability to lump all of those in under the same banner headline of extremism creates helps trigger mechanisms that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization set out, and but the bilateral ties that the countries have in order to get those people returned to their country of origin quickly. So I think obviously it is taking advantage of a real problem, but extending its scope dramatically to cover all potential sources of challenge to their rule. And I think that's very clearly part of it, but also, as John said, part of this is also the fact that those communities can project their message more easily online to those to the countries in the region, and they can be monitored in doing that, and also challenged via social media. So I know not in Central Asia, but there's some examples in this publication about the way in which the Chechen security services threaten through YouTube and obviously have directly put pressure on people because of what have been put up online. And so you see that in a number of cases in Central Asia. So I think, and as John said, you know, Nadija Atayeva's contribution to the report looks at the way in which moles have effectively been put inside the diaspora communities inside Norway, and where there's a significant Uzbek migrant labour community, and I think obviously there are examples across the region where that sort of traditional surveillance is being done by people within plants within the diaspora communities.
So where this intensification comes from, why authorities are intensifying this, what could be the reason behind this? Earlier, Kyrgyzbek, you were saying that there is some blame to go to opposition leaders in Tajikistan.
Yes, just to give you an example, I think part of the reason is that, like in the case of Islamic Revival Party of Tajikistan, I think the party should have been more engaged at an earlier stage in the social and economic development of the country and work more closer with the people. And then what happened was that after, even before the parliamentary election in 2015, I think a couple of months before the election and after the election, the chairman of the party started, initiating high-profile meetings and conferences in different countries, including in Russia. And the message was that the central authority are not following the terms and conditions set in the peace agreement, and maybe it's time for the main actors, being Russia and Iran, to support this reinitiation of a negotiation between the opposition and the central government.
So, sorry to interrupt you, Kyrgyzbek, but how it is related to the intensified pressure, harassment of the authorities?
Maybe the central authorities were afraid that this could lead again to some sort of negotiation which would strengthen the position of the party and the opposition inside the country. That's why, you know, we could see the all sorts of instances where the members of the Islamic Revival Party were quickly labeled as radicals or as having some links to terrorist organization, because before that they were legally operating in the political space, but now that they are labeled as radicals or Islamic terrorists, then it's easier to deal with them. So the authorities were afraid that this could lead to another peace negotiation or etc. And then in order to prevent this from happening, they initiated this very aggressive campaign against.
And response?
If I could come in briefly, please. I mean, I accept that the authorities were fearful, but I have a slightly different understanding of the process to that. I think clearly the government had consolidated power by 2006, 2008, and when the Islamic Party was challenged, there were a few moments where it could have gone to the streets, or it could have exercised its power and, let's say, been a bit more assertive, and it did not do so. I think from my perspective, the impetus here came from the government itself. It clearly chose about 5 years ago, maybe slightly earlier, that it was going to take out the party. And there have been there's been a progression of incidents over the last 5 years to do that. That was a choice. It didn't have to do that. It chose to go on a hard authoritarian route because it had been consolidated in power by that stage. It would have been less of a choice. It was 15 years ago, because the country was still disorderly and the state itself, the central government, didn't have that power. But now it does. It has had that over the recent years. And it made a choice to repress its opponents from the civil war because it wishes to tell a story which eradicates them from the civil war history. Right. Where the government itself can simply be seen as the saviors of the country, and the role of the United Tajik opposition in reconciling themselves can kind of be erased from history or told in a manner which the government is wholly happy with.
Bruce, do you want to jump in here? I mean, can the dissidents might be doing something different, which potentially triggering this repressive move by the authorities in Central Asia?
You know, these are all entrenched systems, with the possible exception of Kyrgyzstan. They've been working under the same management, so to speak, for years and years. I think they're getting extremely intolerant of any kind of criticism or even the potential that there's going to be criticism out there. You know, as we just heard with the Tajik civil war, as Dr. Hedershaw was saying, that the Tajik government would prefer to control the narrative on how the civil war was, the history of the civil war, how it was fought, who was the winner, who was the architect of peace. And I think that's generally true across the board in Central Asia, again, with the possible exception of Kyrgyzstan, that these governments want to tell a story, a happy story of a great nation with a great leader. And they're really worried because we see that things aren't going actually very well at the moment for most of them, economically speaking. Yeah. And so they don't want another, especially an authoritative voice, which in the case of Tajikistan, we did have to a large extent with the Islamic Renaissance Party. This was a partner in the government for a long time. They had a large constituency. You know, this is the thing that these governments fear the most. If you remember years ago when the Islamic Renaissance Party first started doing their own social programs and going out and trying to help people find apartments or you know, advocating that they have better water and stuff like that, it forced the Tajik government to do the same thing. They came late, and for a while they followed the IRPT's habits and just did them one better all the time. And I think they got tired of even having to deal with even that level of competition. So really, I think that's the story, is that these governments have become convinced that their system is there, it's working for them, and they don't want to hear anything different from anybody else.
Okay, thank you very much. So the fact that Central Asian countries are reaching out to dissidents in exile in the business of extradition or the harassment of activists by the authoritarian leaders of Central Asia, one agency plays a crucial role, and that is Interpol. We will talk about this and the foreign allies of the Central Asian states shortly. First, let me recap the debate. I'm joined by the Adam Hogue, Policy Director of Foreign Policy Center, Dr. John Hedershaw, Professor at the Exeter University, also author of the Exiled Database, Kyrgyzbek Kanunov, founding member of Tajikistan's Coalition for Civil Society in Jews, who's exiled in the United States. Ruslan Matiyev is with us from Europe, who's the editor of Alternative News Turkmenistan. Bruce Bonnier is joining us from Prague, who's the editor of Kishlak Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Bloc. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Now, let's talk a little bit about the foreign states and agencies which are providing helping hand, let's say, or being manipulated by the Central Asian authorities to achieve their objectives. We will talk about the agencies in a minute. In terms of countries, Adam, it looks like Russia and Turkey tops the list. Tell us more what role they are playing in this dirty business.
Well, I think obviously Russia tops the list because of the size and scope of the diaspora communities within Russia, and obviously the fact that it is one of the easiest places for exiles to get as a first port of call when they're trying to exit their country. Nominally, it is supposed to be covered by the European Convention on Human Rights, although obviously as of last December they've watered down some of those protections, but in reality those protections weren't helping Central Asian dissidents who were being picked up by the Russian authorities, released and then immediately scooped off the streets by the security forces of their home country and bundled into planes or cars and return and suddenly reappearing within Tajikistan or Uzbekistan. So obviously Russia, as the report sets out through what Mark Galeotti describes the repress intern, there is the long-standing relationships between the security services in Russia that help make that possible. Obviously Turkey, again, significant diaspora communities, some relationships between the security services, limited protections there. And obviously, but the report goes further that it does show how those regimes are penetrating into Western Europe. And the point you make about Interpol is absolutely critical, both to this publication and to some other ones we've done recently, that the Interpol is being used as a tool to pressure people, even when there is no realistic chance that they will be extradited to those countries, so particularly in the case of those who've made it to Western Europe or the United States or elsewhere. But it is a tool to put pressure on those activists and stop them going about their business, stop them travelling, putting them on edge, making it very difficult for them to get by day to day. And so the report looks at the way in which Interpol is used as a tool like that. And despite the rhetoric that's been coming out of Interpol that there is a reform process underway, which our good colleagues at Fair Trials International have been championing, there still seems to be a number of cases where that's still happening. So obviously, a couple of high-profile Tajik cases recently. So that's as John's pointed out. There's a lot more work that can be done there.
Right. And also, some of the Central Asian countries are members of all sorts of cooperation agreements with Russia, and then that enables and allows them to hand over the so-called.
Absolutely. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization has got a reciprocal arrangement where you recognize anti-terror legislation in other countries, even if you don't have precisely the same rules on your books. And it sets up a permission framework to help return people who are seen as challenging their states. And it's and backed up similarly within the structures of the CIS and the CSTO. So the report does touch on those sort of big structural things that happen there, but obviously within the region, at the heart of it is that bilateral relationship, and those are the personal relationships between the security services that mean, while those international agreements are relevant in terms of helping setting the tone, the practical basis is that interpersonal and the relationship between the different security services in the region.
The way some of the extraditions took place, I'm referring to another case from your report, Adam and Jones, the case of Maksud Ibragimov, a Tajik dissident with Russian citizenship. The way he was taken back to Tajikistan was very, very striking. He was put in the airline baggage, I believe.
Yes.
So he's taken from a country of his citizenship. It looks like a kind of cowboy era that we are living in that part of the world. So some of these arrangements cannot fit into any sort of bilateral cooperation or the intergovernmental cooperation. So we are talking something about beyond that, isn't it?
I agree. Just to say that I think the truth comes out in the patterns, and the patterns of rendition, it's not really extradition. Sometimes you have extradition, would be illegal under international law, but extradition formally. But more often it's rendition or disappearance, where persons are released onto the street and then taken off the street. There's obviously connivance between the security services in that. The timings make it clear. The European Court of Human Rights judgments make that very explicit, pointing to the evidence that suggests such connivance. And that, yes, is about informal connections. It's informal connections between security services under the arrangements of the Minsk Convention of the Commonwealth Independent States, which, basically gives primacy to decision-makers in the security services over any sort of international legal or human rights constraints. But nevertheless, it's informal connections, and it's simply these sort of these personal ties and the freedom of movement of all kinds of people, security services people, but also organized crime people who are linked into and related to the security services. And I think that's where Turkey tells us a certain story, because there what we have is diasporas who are partly commercial, partly criminal, partly political, and there's a mixing there of such people. So, the Umar Ali Kuvatov case it seems to be one there where, amongst Tajik diaspora in Turkey, there was obviously some infiltration of his group and his associates by those who sought to remove him and eradicate him to assassinate him. So I think there are all these levels and layers to this, which, are largely informal. They're not going to be resolved by some new human rights agreement or treaty. No formal instrument is going to prevent this from happening, I'm afraid.
The Interpol reform very much focuses on, you know, how people who've made it to the West. That is where the impact of that will be most felt. Inside the region, it is very much law of the jungle. But there is still some benefit, obviously, in ensuring that the European Court of Human Rights is able to act swiftly on to make interim determinations in some of these cases. But yeah, it, as we show in the report, can be flouted.
I mean, the countries, the Turkey and Russia, or some of the other Eastern European countries, or within Central Asia, these are the countries where they are not known with great respect to democratic values. But the thing that you have raised, Adam, the case of Interpol is interesting. I mean, it's an international body with membership from all over the world, including democratic countries in the West. And the way it's being manipulated is very interesting. I think, Bruce, we were looking into how some names swiftly put into the Interpol's red alert list from Uzbekistan and how they were taken down immediately after the leadership change in Uzbekistan. How does it work, really?
Well, I think every government has a right to make a request that Interpol detain persons of interest to that particular government. Then it's up to Interpol to determine whether this is a legitimate request or not. And of course, as this report goes into, and others have mentioned too, the problems with a lot of these things is the people that are wanted in Central Asia are wanted on terrorism charges. And it's really hard to define what terrorism means to some of these Central Asian governments. Being an opponent of the government seems to be, by definition, also being a terrorist. You know, so a group, an organization like Interpol has to look at the request and see some of the evidence that this is based on. Why do they consider this person a terrorist, and why do they want them to come back? You know, often enough, and we've seen even in Prague with Mohammed Salih, for instance, quite a 10, 12 years back, that they do detain people while they try to determine whether they are legitimately wanted back home or whether this is part of a government campaign against them, and the charges on the Interpol list don't match with the person's actions. But like I said, it's a weird line, because the Central Asian governments are always going to make the case that we're part of the war on terrorism and we want to, you know, we're trying to help out too. And also, in a lot of cases, they can say we are on the front line of the war on terrorism, because three of them border Afghanistan. You know, it's kind of hard. You know, when for those of us who watch the region, we can see a lot of this is bogus, and you know, there's no basis in trying to detain these people. For someone with Interpol that's got a long list of people from all over the world, you know, then you do have to detain them and do a little bit of homework to find out what it is, because terrorism is a serious charge, and there's a responsibility on the part of governments and international organizations to detain and keep these people, you know, from causing problems, mischief in parts of the world.
Adam or John, probably you had a chance to do more research on this than us. The way people are placed in the Interpol's list is also interesting. Like, I think I saw this in the Dr. Lemon's report on Tajikistan, that today there are 1,661 people registered in the Interpol's red alert list alone from Tajikistan. And one of them is Muhyiddin Kabiri, and he's accused in corruption and terrorism. How on earth can Interpol be convinced on such accusation, really?
Yeah, I think we need to recognize that they are not going through some kind of forensic and systematic process of checking. There's a lot of evidence to show that there are very few checks, and sometimes wholesale placing of such notices online without proper checking. I don't know. I mean, I think there are lots of questions about the internal functioning of Interpol, its bureaucracy, its resources. It's going through a reform process at the moment. So, you know, we should perhaps wait to see what comes out in 2017 in terms of whether they have instituted a formal checking process. And part of the objective of exercises like our database is to collate and analyze such information so that patterns can be spotted, so that Interpol or any other body can't turn around and say, well, we're not aware of these patterns. Well, they're there, you know, you can see them, and you can see recurrent patterns of politically motivated requests to Interpol, recurrent patterns of abusing these systems. And I think, you know, for research purposes and for human rights purposes, that's the virtue of sort of trying to see the patterns taking place here. It's not just about individual cases. It's about a broader process.
Yes, there are definite capacity issues in Interpol and a definite lack of specialist knowledge. I think what's important to flag up, though, is that obviously cases like the Kabiri case obviously are very troubling, but obviously his high profile and those of other high profile cases that have gone through the Interpol system get flagged up quite quickly. But within that 1,400 group of people that Ed points out, there's going to be lots of people within that who don't have access to the resources and networks that some of these more high-profile figures have. So while it's very tough for some of these more high-profile dissidents who, as in I've worked, the Kazakhs have gone through it with a number of people in the opposition and Ablyazov networks in their country where they've been picked up. But obviously those are, quite high-profile cases. But within that bulk of cases that are on that Interpol wanted list, it's 1,661 citizens of Tajikistan, according to Ed Lemon, on that Interpol wanted list. Yeah, triaging through that is a massive bureaucratic task, and obviously Tajikistan is just one country that Interpol's dealing with. So we appreciate the challenges they face, but it is flagging up country, ensuring that Interpol has mechanisms that show countries that have a track record of manipulating the system and bumping those up the top of the queue in terms of what the mechanisms internally that check these things.
Yeah, I wish I would have someone to explain this from Interpol's point of view, but I also understand that as an international police force, they are also obliged to listen to its members, I believe. Mm. But anyway, so this is
it's a member-led organization, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a reality. Now, what to do about it? I mean, is there any mechanism where states can be prevented, or is there anything an individual can do? The ones especially who are faced with extradition, let's say in Europe, but again in Russia and countries like Turkey, that's kind of questionable. But imagine a person is faced with this situation. Is there anything they can do to prevent it from happening?
Well, I mean, most European EU member states will go through due process of law with a number of these cases, and if there is a significant, if they're able to show that these people have been politically active in the countries of Central Asia, they're not likely to be sent back due to the concerns about non-refoulement and everything else. So obviously those protections, even if you have an Interpol red notice out on you within the EU, it's a significant impediment to your activities, but it's not necessarily automatically meaning that you're going to get returned. Obviously, inside the region, that's a very different case, as John has I've already spoken about. But it's also worth flagging up that obviously these I'll come back to it in a second.
Well, just to add that Interpol does have an appeals process, so you can get a red notice or another notice removed, but it takes years, and groups like Fair Trials International in London do assist people to have notices removed when they're obviously politically motivated, but it can take a long time. So part of the reform process was to question the current appeals process and to get that changed.
Okay, thank you very much for your insightful thoughts, Adam Hawk, Policy Director of Foreign Policy Center, and Dr. John Hidershaw, Professor at Exeter University, also author of the Exile Database, and Kyrgyzbek Kanunov, founding member of Tajikistan's Coalition for Civil Society, NGO Ruslan Matiev, editor of Alternative News Turkmenistan, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, for this fascinating discussion. Gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.